In a moment, what does your iPod or cell phone charger have to do with coal mining? A conversation about our dependence on burning coal to produce electricity. But first, to Iraq, where at least 10 American soldiers have been killed this week, keeping August on track to be one of the worst months for deaths of American servicemen since the surge. And yesterday, coordinated insurgent bombings targeted the Yazidi minority in the north of the country, killing nearly 200 civilians. This as Washington awaits General David Petraeus' September report on progress in the war in Iraq. Well, today the Los Angeles Times reports on what he might recommend and on the debate in the White House about how to write the report. With us is Julian Barnes, Pentagon correspondent for the LA Times. Julian, first of all, making news today, your report on possible troop movement. Tell us what you're hearing.
Administration officials have told us they expect that General Petraeus will recommend removing some troops from once volatile areas, potentially including the Sunni-dominated Anbar province to the west.
And we've been hearing reports of how Sunni groups that had been fighting the U.S. are now fighting al-Qaeda in Iraq forces in that area.
That's been a strong message from the U.S. military for months now about how they've made some important gains in Anbar. And what we're hearing Petraeus wants to do is show that they can translate those gains into troop reductions in those areas.
But those troops would then do what?
Well, that's a great question. It may be that Petraeus recommends reducing the overall troop number, but that's just one option. He might instead move them into another area that he wants to concentrate troops, perhaps one of these rings around Baghdad that has been the focus for the last couple months, or he could create a reserve force which he could call forward in case some trouble breaks out.
And this, as you write, would solve several problems. The White House wouldn't have to ask for more troops. And this move might also diffuse pressure from calls for full withdrawal.
That's right. It would show progress going forward, and it would show that progress in security can lead to reduced troops. And the goal of Petraeus and the other supporters of the surge is to win more time with this higher number of troops and, you know, head off calls in Congress to reduce to a very small number quickly.
But your reporting comes as we watch the British withdrawal from Basra, and the vacuum that's created has led to violence there. And we're also reminded that General Petraeus's pacification of Mosul years ago was widely praised, but violence resumed there quickly after U.S. forces withdrew.
Military officers in Iraq tell me one of Petraeus's top priorities is to make sure any gains in security are not eroded by moving troops around, what General Petraeus calls changing the geometry of Iraq. They're very conscious of the Basra situation. They want to make sure that Anbar does not become a second Basra and descend into chaos.
Well, and we're also reading today about yesterday's terrible bombing up in the north, at least 175 killed. Didn't U.S. forces just withdraw or recently withdraw from that area?
Yeah, U.S. forces over the last 9 months have been reducing the number of troops in cities like Mosul, and critics, people who want to keep a higher troop presence in these areas, say, hey, you can't move too quickly on this or you're going to get grand bombings like we saw yesterday.
Well, another striking thing in your story is what administration officials told you about the authorship of this report, that while General Petraeus and Ambassador Ryan Crocker will give their information to the White House, it's the White House that's going to write the report, and there's apparently great debate within the White House as to how it's going to be written, and even basic issues like how do you define satisfactory progress?
The debate in the White House is that the law that requires these reports says, have the Iraqis made satisfactory progress on the benchmarks? Well, that gives you a little latitude in how you answer it. And some people say, well, you know, we see progress. They're moving ahead on some of these. And other people in the White House say, wait a minute, the only thing that matters is, does the progress they're making in Iraq have any effect on the ground? And so that's what we should focus on. So that's the debate inside the White House. But the senior administration officials are intent on noting, you know, the recommendations will be Petraeus's, but the report will be written here in Washington.
And is there a sense that it will be Petraeus's conclusions? This is a White House that's been accused of cherry-picking.
The officials we spoke to emphasized that it will be Petraeus's recommendations, that they may debate about how they talk about the progress and how they describe advancing on the benchmarks, but the recommendations, the way forward, is going to be from Ambassador Ryan Crocker and General Petraeus.
Julian Barnes, Pentagon correspondent for the LA Times. Julian, thank you.
Thank you.
The effort to find six miners trapped in a Utah coal mine continues, but after more than a week, hopes are fading. So far, two holes drilled into the mine have only yielded ghostly video images of piles of rubble and abandoned equipment, no sign of the miners. Well, journalist Jeff Goodell is following the developments in Utah closely. He's the author of Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future, and Our Story. That's about the rescue of nine miners who were trapped in a Pennsylvania coal mine for 3 days back in 2002. He joins us now. Jeff, you've spoken to people on the scene in Utah. Do you think there is a chance that these miners are alive?
Well, you know, the rescue operation is certainly proceeding as if there is a chance, and these guys are not going to give up hope and not going to slow down this operation at all until they get to these men, whether they are dead or alive. But, you know, frankly, we're coming up on almost 10 days underground now since the collapse, and it's really tough. And
yeah,
one of the toughest things is that there's been no communication with these guys, which is really difficult.
There have been miraculous mine rescues. Two coal miners survived for 23 days underground in 1983. Two gold miners in Australia were rescued after 14 days. And you, as we said, wrote a book about the nine miners rescued after 3 days in a Pennsylvania coal mine. Just briefly, you know, what was that like for them in there?
The psychological part of it is really what's most difficult, you know, the absolute blackness, the disorientation, the thinking about death, the waiting and waiting and waiting for rescue, because the hard thing is that there's nothing they can really do if they are alive. They can't claw their way out. All they can do is basically barricade themselves in and wait.
You talk about the blackness, but on the other hand, remember that we're remembering that terrible Sago mine collapse and the note that the miner wrote to his family, that he said, "I just went to sleep."
Right. I mean, every miner knows this, prepares for this. And, you know, if they did survive the initial collapse and they did have some time in the mine, the first thing they would all do is write a note to their family. It's a kind of terrible tradition among coal miners that, you know, when they're trapped underground, this is what they do. And they will, you know, they will take any kind of paper that they can find or anything that they can find and use a pen, or even sometimes they scrawl on it with coal notes to their loved ones that they hope will be found with their bodies. And the miners in Pennsylvania certainly did that, and then were very lucky, of course, and didn't have any need for them. Mm. And ended up sealing them off and burning them and never showing them to anyone. We're just not going to know what's going on here, really, until we get to these guys.
Well, on the other hand, we had a slight smile, because we read today that you said that in one of the rescues, the miners, you know, received food and things were lowered down to them, including an iPod, to entertain them.
Right.
And when we last spoke, you said our shiny white iPod economy is propped up by dirty black rocks.
That's right.
Yeah,
I never considered that connection, but that's true.
Right. I mean, you know, we are enjoying the labor of these men.
Absolutely. And, you know, these men are laboring in, you know, the most kind of invisible jobs. I mean, they're literally, their jobs are invisible, mining coal. And we never think about these guys who are down in these coal mines right now as we speak, who are down in these coal mines 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, risking their lives to dig this coal out of the ground.
Jeff Goodell, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
Well, we want to revisit that earlier conversation that I just mentioned. We spoke with Jeff last summer about his book, Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. To put coal use into perspective for us, he said that Americans tend to think of China as a much bigger user of coal, but per capita, coal consumption in the U.S. is three times what it is in China.
We don't use coal anymore like we used to power railroads, for heating in our home, and, you know, in the basement we used to have coal bins and stuff like that. Now it's burned almost exclusively in these really enormous power plants that are around the United States that are kind of out of sight and out of mind, and because it's not a tangible part of our daily life anymore, like it still is in China, we forget how crucial it is.
Right. Well, and by the way, what's the problem with that? Critics could cherry pick from your book the way they would from like a bad movie review to make a pro-coal argument, because as you write, coal
has virtues. It can be shipped by boats or railroad. It's easy to store. It's easy to burn. It's plentiful. It's abundant in the U.S. It's the cheapest way to generate electricity. In fact, the U.S. has 25% of the world's recoverable coal reserves. The Middle East has the oil, but the U.S. has coal. So those sound like really good things. What are the problems?
Well, there's two problems. One of the big problems is that coal is an enormously politically influential. So there have been a lot of sort of regulatory rollbacks and things that have allowed the coal industry to, you know, essentially get away with things that are enormously destructive, such as keeping the burning of dirty coal plants going and a kind of mountaintop removal mining in West Virginia and Appalachia.
Let's explain that mountaintop removal, where you literally, instead of going in to dig for the coal, you just dig away the mountain until it's gone and you find the coal.
That was one of the stunning things when I first started reporting this book in 2001. I went to West Virginia for the New York Times Magazine, and I'd never seen any of these enormous mountaintop removal mines, which are essentially strip mines kind of on steroids. They use ammonium nitrate explosives to blow up the mountain, and they dump the debris of the mountain into nearby streams and rivers and then get the coal out that way rather than tunneling underground the way they used to.
Well, I'm going to go through your other items from the negative list of coal's impact. You say, yes, it might have been plentiful at one time, but now the coal that's available is harder to find. It's deeper. It's harder to get at. And it's also in places where, you know, what are you going to do with the houses that are sitting on top of it?
Coal boosters, including President Bush, often like to claim that we're the Saudi Arabia of coal. And we do have lots of coal, but unfortunately it's not sitting in a big shiny pile in the middle of the country. It's deeply buried under national parks, under cities, under farms, and we can get it and it's there if we need it, but it's going to be enormously destructive to get it out of the ground.
You say it wasn't supposed to be this way. Coal was supposed to give way to nuclear energy, to gas. What happened?
It's essentially a kind of perfect storm of things that came together to give birth to this coal boom that we're seeing right now. And part of it is the rise of natural gas prices, making natural gas, which is the main competitor to coal for electric power generation, much more expensive. Mm-hmm. Renewable energy like wind and solar are not ready for, you know, prime time in a big way yet. The Bush administration, since the 2000 election, has made no secret of the fact that it is a good friend of the coal industry, and they've rolled back a number of regulations that have made it easier and more profitable for the coal industry to thrive. And so they've taken advantage of that.
Jeff Goodale's book is Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. When we come back, what does he see in the future for coal production? Can it, for instance, be turned into liquid fuel to run automobiles? Also, later in the program, we're going to talk to Dr. Timothy Johnson. How worried should parents be about lead in their kids' toys? And we have a cautionary tale about magnets and a child's nose. Back after the break, here and now. As the search for six miners trapped in that Utah coal mine continues, we're revisiting a conversation we had last summer with journalist Jeff Goodale, author of Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. It's about the price we pay for the coal we depend on to keep the lights on or charge iPods. He says even the industries that use coal know that one day they're going to have to pay a fine of sorts, an emissions tax, for the carbon they create by burning coal. That's one of his suggestions. But he also says he doesn't think the coal mining industry should be shut down. So what should happen?
What should happen is that this industry should be reined in. I think that it's gotten away with a lot of stuff in recent years. And, you know, I think that we as Americans need to think about what kind of price we really want to pay for our energy. Coal is often touted as a cheap source of energy. But when you look at the true costs, from air pollution deaths, from the destruction of Appalachia from these big mines, when you look at miners who were killed underground, and most important, if you take global warming at all seriously, and you look at this big build-out of coal plants, you know, it's anything but cheap. power, and it's a way of sort of exploiting the present and mortgaging our future, this new build out in coal.
Talk about the connection between coal mining and global warming.
The connection between coal burning and global warming is profound. You can, in a matter of speaking, in fact, some climate scientists go so far as to say, you know, the problem with carbon dioxide emissions, which are the main greenhouse gas, is a problem of coal. Coal is by far the most carbon intensive of all fossil fuels. And these giant coal plants that burn so much coal and generate so much electricity are also huge sources of carbon dioxide emissions. To give you an example, one of the coal plants that I looked into, a new coal plant that's going up in Illinois, will emit roughly twice as much carbon dioxide as every car built by Ford Motor Company this year. So these are enormous sources of CO2. And if you're going to begin to rein in CO2, then coal is the first thing that you have to deal with.
If I've seen any criticism of the book, and it's rare and it's small, it is that you sound as perhaps unenthusiastic about other sources of fuel, wind energy, solar energy, as the coal companies would like Americans to be. Do you think that they are way too far in the future?
No, I'm not unenthusiastic about other kinds of energy. I'm unenthusiastic about predicting the future. People will always say, well, if we're not going to burn coal, you know, we'll have to, you know, cover the entire state of South Dakota with solar panels or something like that. And mm-hmm. I grew up in Silicon Valley, and I worked in the computer industry. I worked at Apple, and I saw how technology moves in unpredictable ways. And, you know, it's impossible to say, you know, where our energy future is going to take us. Mm. What it is possible to do is make judgments about what we care about. Do we care about preserving the Appalachian Mountains, or are we willing to write them off for a sacrifice for cheap energy? Do we care about our climate? Do we want a stable climate? If we do, we need to make decisions about, you know, carbon dioxide emissions. And then once we make those decisions and set out essentially a kind of playing field, then I'm all for letting the entrepreneurs and the businessmen and the people who are good at this, the engineers, figure out how to do it. And I think that once you get a playing field that is fair and reflects the values that we really want to underscore, then there's going to be a kind of flowering and a kind of great unleashing of entrepreneurial spirit.
But you and others have said there's not enough time. I mean, this is, many people feel this is critical and has to be done today, change in coal, in order not to impact the global warming in the way you outline.
It doesn't have to be done today in the sense that we need to shut down every coal plant. But I think that we need to, you know, get on with taking this seriously and moving seriously in the direction of progress. I mean, one of the problems is we have 140 or so new coal plants planned in America or permitted, and only a handful, maybe five or six, use a kind of coal gasification technology which will allow the carbon dioxide to be someday captured and sequestered underground so it doesn't go into the atmosphere. So that means that the other 130 or so power plants are just continuing with business as usual. And, you know, from a climate point of view, letting that go forward is a disaster.
You know, coal as the fuel of the future also pulls up short, I would think, when you think of it replacing oil. Is it possible to run all of the engines that run on oil with coal?
No. I'm glad you brought that up, because the centerpiece of the sort of argument to use more coal is because of the war in the Middle East and energy independence. But in fact, as we talked about earlier, coal is almost entirely used for electricity generation today. And of course, oil is not used for electricity, entirely used for transportation. And it is possible to build a kind of coal refinery that can liquefy coal into diesel fuel. That's the one that they can do gasoline, but mostly diesel right now. It's possible to do, but it's a kind of gold-plated Cadillac solution to America's problem with oil addiction in the Middle East. Mm. These plants are very expensive. They take a long time to build, and most importantly, they're a big step backwards when it comes to dealing with carbon dioxide emissions and greenhouse gases, because they emit roughly twice as much of these gases as a conventional refinery.
Well, Jeff Goodell, you say big coal should be reined in. One critic sort of characterized your solution as a kind of national psychotherapy program. But your words were to change Americans' thinking, to make the invisible visible. What does that mean? What would you like to see?
Well, I think one of the problems with the way we use electricity in America, and I was part of this prior to working on this book, is that, you know, we think that electricity as this sort of golden juice that flows down from a bowl in the sky or something, and we have no real sense of the connection of where it comes from and what it really costs us. And I think that if we go blindly into this coal boom, I think that we are going to look back in 10 years and say, oh my God, what have we done? I mean, look what happened to Appalachia. There used to be mountains there. They're gone. You know, look at these dead coal miners. And most importantly, we have a climate that's out of control. And we did all this in order to get cheap power to run our iPods. That was not a good deal.
Jeff Goodell, author of Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. We spoke with him last summer, and we'll continue to follow today's story of six coal miners trapped in Utah. Looking ahead tomorrow on Here and Now, one man's disaster, another's opportunity. As Arctic ice melts, it's revealing business opportunities. And still ahead today, air guitar from the bedroom to the big stage. After the news, Here and Now. Parents are once again rummaging through toy chests, winnowing out the latest in recalled playthings. This time, it's Big Bird, Dora the Explorer, and Sarge the Car. Millions of toys were recalled by Mattel in the second recall in 2 weeks because they contain lead paint. Toys that contain magnets were also recalled. Health officials say no children have been poisoned or injured by the toys, but they point out that growing children absorb far more of the lead they ingest than adults, 50% as compared to 10% for adults. And children also have a less developed blood-brain barrier, which means more of the lead they take in affects their brain and nervous system. And some officials are pointing out that kids are also playing with secondhand and antique toys made before lead in toys was banned in the U.S. in 1978. So, what's a parent to do? Dr. Timothy Johnson is medical editor at ABC News and a frequent contributor to Here and Now. Dr. Tim, let's start with the issue of lead paint. Remind us, what happens when a child ingests too much lead?
Well, the acute dangers, that is, in ingesting very large amounts, are very obvious to a parent. They can lead to seizures, severe abdominal discomfort, imbalance. The child can go into a coma.
This is when kids maybe eat lead from paint chips.
Oh, yes, but they'd have to eat huge amounts to get this so-called acute lead poisoning. And that's relatively rare, and it gets taken care of quickly because the child is obviously very sick. What we worry a lot more about are the much more subtle changes that can occur in a child who has chronic lead poisoning, that is, taking in small amounts over a long period of time, may not produce any obvious physical symptoms, but could certainly interfere with brain development, and that's what we worry about in kids who are measured blood-wise to have higher than normal levels of lead.
Well, now that, you know, chronic over a period of time, that can happen with paint chips, but can that happen with toys? I mean, how much do you have to chew on your toy car to get that?
I think that's a very focused question for parents, and the vast majority of the experts that our office talked to yesterday said they were not that concerned about the toys, precisely because they felt most kids wouldn't have long-term exposure, large amounts. And indeed, we are talking about kids at a younger age who will still put things in their mouth, not about older kids who don't. Mm. So they are still much more concerned about lead paint, which is still found in, I think, some 28 million homes in this country, even though it's been banned since the late 1970s, because younger kids will pick up paint chips, paint dust, they'll put all that stuff in their mouth. But it may be slowly and over a period of time, and only later in life will they be diagnosed as maybe having some mental retardation or hyperactivity syndrome that could be attributed to that lead.
Well, so let's be clear. You make the distinction between older and younger. Let's say you have an 8-year-old who has a lot of these toys and maybe just been handling them but not putting them in his mouth. Can you get lead poisoning by having it go through your skin?
Not really. It has to be ingested to really get into the bloodstream. And so for the 8-year-old, I wouldn't worry at all about lead paint unless they are a mouth person still, but I would worry about those magnets.
Well, we're going to get to the magnets, but if you have one of the little toddlers that has been popping a little toy car in his mouth, what should you do? Should you get tested?
There's no black and white answer. Many experts would say if it's just been occasional, you haven't had the toy that long, probably not. But bottom line for me would be to say, if you're concerned, call your doctor and see about getting a blood test, because that's the only objective way to know what might have gotten into your child's bloodstream and into the body.
Okay, because there are no symptoms. There's nothing you'd be looking for.
Again, for the low ingestion, chronic, long-term, usually no symptoms that you notice.
Well, how about these magnets? We understand that if swallowed, they can join together, create blockages in the stomach. Explain this.
Well, they join together, and because they're large and attracting each other sometimes from different places even, they can cause perforations. They can go right through the walls of organs like the intestines, and so that's one problem. The other problem with these small objects of any kind is choking, and in fact, there are more choking deaths every year in this country from toys than for any other reason. And so you really have to be aware of the choking danger from any small object. Magnets, of course, are one, but if you look at the toys, they're full of small objects that little kids can ingeniously and cleverly pull off and put right in their mouth. So that's, to me, really the great concern that parents should have about their toys.
Well, the Consumer Product Safety Commission is saying that so far there have been no reported injuries from these magnets or poisonings from the lead toys. At a certain time, all toys had lead paint. I mean, antique toys still do, and we didn't feel we saw kids keeling over in the 40s, or did we, and people didn't know what it was from?
Well, they may have been part of the source of the chronic, low-grade, long-term poisoning that wasn't being detected. But even at that time, I think lead paint from homes was a major source. Now, it's true that in the recent recall, there haven't been any particular problems with those toys, but in general, I'm saying that choking on small objects is a major cause of death and disability in kids. So whether or not it's these particular toys, parents should certainly be aware of any small objects, not even toys necessarily, just any small object that their child might put in their mouth.
Well, and I'm thinking, you know, refrigerator magnets that you've got way down low on the fridge, things like that. I mean, just makes us think more. Dr. Tim Johnson, medical editor of ABC News and Here and Now contributor. Dr. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, in discussing the dangers of magnets in kids' toys, one of our colleagues happened to mention that she was at a bar mitzvah where a child actually got magnets stuck in his nose, to which we said, what? On the line with us now is Narayan Kaimal. It was his son, Rajan, who was 9 at the time, who had this happen. Narayan, first of all, tell us, you were at a bar mitzvah. Were these magnets in party favors?
Yeah, they were in things that they give away to all the kids, and they were a magnet on one side and a light on the other. Mm-hmm. And kids were putting them in their ears as earrings around the lobe.
Oh, I know the kind you mean. You put it behind your earlobe, for instance. The magnet goes behind, and then the light's on your earlobe.
Of course. And my son, who was always ready to play for a laugh, decided to put one in either nostril, as if he had nose rings on either side.
And what happened?
Decided to take them both off at his parents' insistence at the exact same time. The magnets flipped and adhered to each other on either side of his septum.
Wait. So he had the light on the outside of his nostrils, the magnets on the inside. He took the lights off at the same time so that the magnets adhered to each other.
Exactly.
Oh, as they adhered to each other, then what happened?
They jumped essentially towards each other on either side of his septum, way up beyond where we could see or he was even aware of them for some time. And we tried to get them out, but we kind of had to go to mass eye and ear to have them removed.
By the way, was that painful? What did they do?
He had to go under general anesthetic, have his stomach pumped, and call in the doctors on a Saturday evening.
Well, this is serious. I guess parents are finding out what you already know. These magnets, if they're ingested, if they get into something, they will rejoin.
They're very, very powerful.
Yeah.
We were really concerned at the time that they were batteries and that the lead in them could, or whatever chemical was in them, could leak. But just, you know, the inconvenience of having large, you know, metal discs in your nose was bad enough.
Well, how is Rajan today?
Oh, he's fine. And he seems to have learned his lesson, but we tell the story to great amusement.
Yes, I imagine. Now,
many years later, but at the time, and with the medical bill arriving, it wasn't quite as amusing.
Yeah, I bet not. Well, Narayan, thanks very much, and our best to Rajan.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Narayan Kaimal of Belmont, Massachusetts, with a cautionary tale about kids, their noses, and small magnets. If you want to see a list of all the toys that have been recently recalled, go to our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. 38 years ago, in an alfalfa field turned concert hall in Bethel, New York, a young bearded man in a floppy cowboy hat took the stage and greeted fans at the Woodstock Music Festival with a rather grandiose plan.
Good morning. What we have in mind is breakfast in bed for 400,000.
Hippie icon Wavy Gravy is now 71. He's still the same old political activist masquerading as a clown. And as John Kalish reports, he has no plans to slow down.
He was dubbed Wavy Gravy by the great blues guitarist B.B. King, but he came into the world as Hugh Romney and has led a life that is best summed up by that Grateful Dead line, "What a long, strange trip it has been." He served in the U.S. Army, studied acting at the acclaimed Neighborhood Playhouse in New York City, moved to California, and started a commune with other hippies.
I refer to myself as a hippie icon, flower geezer, and temple of accumulated error.
Wavy Gravy and his Southern California commune were on the scene in the early days of psychedelic drug use. That chapter of his life is celebrated in Tom Wolfe's The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test and in a 9-minute song composed by Ed Sanders, a member of the outrageous 1960s rock band The Fugs.
He found a way of dropping out in a time of trips and acid tests. He helped create a collective, they called it the Hog Farm.
The Hog Farm owns a couple of houses in Berkeley, California today, where Wavy Gravy spends most of the year organizing benefit concerts for a variety of causes. Wavy Gravy is convinced the most important part of his legacy will be Camp Winter Rainbow in Northern California, where kids live in teepees, learn circus arts, and do morning warm-up exercises led by a camp counselor with a fake Scottish accent.
Everybody, we're going to start with the vocal warm-up. All right, our knees are where we're going to start. Everybody, let's see.
We're not creating little circus stars or movie stars, although it has happened. What we're creating is universal human beings that can dig and deal with anything that comes down the pike with timing, balance, compassion, and a sense of humor.
The world sees Wavy as a clown, but he's actually a very deep man.
Dr. Larry Brilliant runs Google.org, the charitable arm of Google.
The reason that Ben and Jerry's named an ice cream after him was to pay homage to him. He's an amazing guy. He's like hidden in plain view. He's well known, but he's not known well.
One of the projects Wavy Gravy has long been involved in that is not well known is the Save a Foundation, which helps poor people around the globe. It was recently awarded $2 million by Google. Gravy has also garnered little public attention for dressing up as a clown and visiting the sick. Barry Melton was lead guitarist of the 1960s rock group Country Joe and the Fish.
Wavy has spent more than 20 years going into children's wards, going into cancer wards, going into hospitals and performing. And it's not anything I've ever read about. It's not anything that he's all that public about. But it's part of his work. That's who he is.
If you have taken the blue and acid, you're going to feel a little queasy in a couple minutes.
Last summer, Wavy Gravy emceed Hippie Fest, a traveling rock tour of 60s nostalgia bands. His manager, Mark Margolis, can only marvel at Gravy's ability to keep on trucking even after several surgeries for a back injury sustained in the early 1970s.
I've seen him unable to stand up, MC a concert on a gurney. No matter how much he's in pain, he's still on the job.
In the months ahead, staying on the job includes readying his Nobody for President campaign in 2008. A documentary about Wavy Gravy's life is set to be nearing completion. It's called Saint Misbehaving.
Producer John Kalish. For more on Wavy Gravy, go to our website, here-now.org. And by the way, Max Yasgur's famous farm near where 3 days of sex, drugs, and rock and roll defined a generation is now for sale. Asking price, $8 million. Still to come, air guitar forever, here and now. I have two separate pictures of two dear friends. One is now a professional guitarist, one is not. But in these old snapshots, both are posing as 8-year-olds, standing on their beds, pretending to play the guitar. Did you do it too? Stand on your bed as a kid, rock out? I can just hear several of you now saying, "What do you mean as a kid? I'm still doing it."
You imagine it in the living room. You're Jimi Hendrix, you're Yngwie Malmsteen, you're anyone you want to be. You just feel like a rock god for a minute.
When you play air guitar, the art of playing nothing has been elevated to extreme sport. The National Air Guitar Championships takes place in New York City tomorrow. Right on cue comes the DVD release of Air Guitar Nation, a film by Alexander Lipsitz, who joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Also joining us, a judge at this year's competition, but also a former competitor and almost world champion, as we see in Alexander's film, Bjorn to Rock, a.k.a. Dan Crane. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Please do me a favor. Spell your stage name.
Well, it's Bjorn, B-J-O-R-N, and then it's to Rock, T-U-R-O-Q-U-E. And then there's, of course, umlauts over the O in Bjorn and over the U in to Rock.
Of course.
Now, umlauts are critical.
We're well aware. We're about to talk for an extended period of time about air guitar, which is a completely visual art. But could you tell us a little bit about your style as Bjorn?
Bjorn is more in the kind of purist school of air guitar. He's trying to keep it real. And basically, a lot of people go for kind of hair metal, that kind of thing.
Right.
I tend more towards the more punk rock, the kind of the music that I was listening to as a kid.
If I could describe it, it's the kind of guitarist who's sort of like taking steps forward, taking steps back, holding most of the guitar work way, way down, just above knee level, maybe looking over his right shoulder, kick splitting every now and then, 1 foot forward, 1 foot back. So have I got it?
Oh, yeah. The occasional windmill doesn't hurt.
That's right. Anyway, so. That's right. And now,
are you a purist when you're in your spandex outfit? That's what I want to know.
Well, no. See, what I learned was that the purist really isn't the way to go to win the competition. So then later in my career, I went for something more glam. That's when I, invested in a one-piece unitard
right.
with dry ice coming out of my sleeve.
And Alexander, you give us an idea of some of these other styles, because there was a guy at one of the national competitions who I thought was disabled until apparently his guitar playing saved him and he got up and walked.
Yeah, there's definitely people who come to the stage with a shtick sort of prepared. There's the purist, and then there's, what is it, Dan?
The performance artist, I guess.
Performance artist who comes with blood capsules and lots of spandex and wigs. And then there's...
robots. I've seen robots.
Robots.
A lot of robots.
Full body paint.
Well, now Dan...
Nudity.
And nudists.
Oh, nudists. Oh, well,
yeah.
I got to say, that was stunning to me, in which, let's just say he had more guitar than most of the competitors.
Yeah, in a lot of places that would be he would be disqualified for using a prop, the naked guy. So I don't know if he didn't score well.
But Dan, you did. You were quite a contender. Let's give some background, because through the film we learned that air guitar competitions had been going on in Finland, but there weren't any in the U.S., the home of rock and roll. What were your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I thought it was crazy. It started in 1996 in Oulu, Finland, as a very small event, and then it really grew and grew. And now I think this year there's 15 or 17 countries from around the world
right.
competing.
Well, and in fact, it was the dream of a couple of air guitar fans who thought, we'll get some people out here, but apparently Howard Stern talked about it on his radio show. And, the rest is history. I mean, hundreds showed up. But and who knew the rest of the world had also been attending a high-altitude air guitar training camp in Finland? Former champ Zach Monroe from London gave a welcome speech to the newcomers. Let's listen to that.
Air guitar is very pure as an art form. You know, it's abstract. It only really exists by what surrounds it and its effect on what surrounds it. It's kind of totally intangible. You can steal a mobile phone or a car. You can take away someone's, possessions. But you can't steal something that's invisible.
So he takes them through their paces, air guitar aerobics classes, the sort of zen of air guitar. So suddenly, Alexander, we're in Spinal Tap. were you surprised? Uh-huh. I mean, or is part of what he's saying tongue-in-cheek? Or
I think that there's definitely some tongue-in-cheek. But one of the things that you find when you first witness one of these live events is that how serious some of the people take it. And then you become a believer just because there is such a thing as airness and these people are really, really good. And then you get to Finland and you just get blown away.
Well, and one of those who soon rises in your eyes and in the film is C. Diddy. He's born David Jung. He competes at the first national championships held above a strip club in New York City and then goes on to Los Angeles. This Bjorn Turok becomes your big competitor. How would you characterize how the two of you sort of warily circle each other?
You know, I would say he was my nemesis.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways still is. I mean, we've buried the hatchet, but, you know, I still one day wish to defeat C. Diddy. You know, I chased him around the world. Basically, from New York to L.A. to Finland, and we'll meet again one day.
Well, in the meantime, he won, and you show Alexandra. I'm sorry,
salt Dan, in the wind.
Yeah, come on. Yeah, he won. I know.
Okay.
Remind me again.
But he has this interesting backstory. His mother and father come to see him. They emigrated from Korea. They wanted him to be a doctor. He wants to be a rock star, perhaps an actor, and definitely an air guitarist. And he gets to the Los Angeles competition after winning in New York. He's received like a rock star. Let's listen.
At some point before I went on, I was just walking around. I could hear someone in the back going, "Oh my God, that's him. That's C. Diddy." You could hear in their voice a certain sense of awe.
Meanwhile, Dan, and again, not to rub it in, but he goes he goes to Finland, you know, because he wins all these regional championships. You go online and raise, what, $460 of the $1,600 you need to get people to help fly you there to compete with him. But you have a lot of respect. Here is what your rivals say about you.
Bjorn Turok, he was pretty flesh, bit of an attitude, shiny out there, which looked pretty cool. Bit of a rock star.
Yeah, I thought he was really good. Yeah, he's probably the best person that I've seen so far. Like, he's better than all the guys from Australia.
He's a guitar player. He's not a stripper. You know what I mean?
Bjorn did okay. I mean, I think he did as well as you can possibly do. That's the best you'll see.
A guitar player, not a stripper. That's good.
Well, you know, I was there to play the guitar. I mean, I can be a stripper if need be.
But I think the
but that was not what I was there for.
I think the implication was that some of the other acts were, like you said, just glam and show and fooling around. But do you actually try to get your finger where the frets might be?
Well, I mean, the little-known secret about Bjorn Turok is that that me, Dan Crane, actually knows how to play what I refer to as the their guitar. I've been playing guitar kind of all my life. So, you know, I actually know where my fingers should be, and I think that that's really what hurt me. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm looking down at my hands to make sure they're in the right place, and that's not what air guitar is about. Air guitar is about putting on an incredible show and making someone believe as if there is a guitar there, but the guitar is not a guitar. It's an air guitar, you know, so it's a totally different animal.
But you're not bitter.
I'm so not bitter, no.
And he's actually a great, great musician.
You know, I've retired into this kind of ambassadorship of air guitar, and I'm pretty happy.
Now you're going to have to dust off that class from the air guitar camp. What to do about all the groupies?
You know...
Oh, if you only knew.
So many groupies.
So
little time.
Little time.
Yeah.
Dan Crane, a.k.a. Bjorn Turok, and Alexander Lipsitz, director of Air Guitar Nation, now out on DVD. For more on the film or the national championships in New York tomorrow, go to our website, here-now.org. I want to thank you both so much. A lot of fun.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Rock and roll.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. How will we continue without intern Ben Singer? We'll have to. He returns to Brown this fall. Best to you, Ben. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us.